Blog Talk Radio.
To urge her to
guarantees safe passage for that
right.
U.S. boat. It's one of the members of the group of boats of the flotilla.
But can I explain this, please?
Go ahead.
It says to just foreign policy. Just put that in your whatever Google or Yahoo or whatever you use, and. It says it's a petition to Hillary Clinton and says, tell Hillary to ensure safe passage for U.S. boat to Gaza. It says, a year ago, an international flotilla of peace and solidarity activists tried to break the siege of Gaza. Israeli authorities attacked the flotilla, took control of the ships, and brought the ships to Israel. Now, an even larger flotilla with the participation of more ships and more activists from more countries, including, crucially, the U.S. ship Audacity of Hope, is preparing to set sail in June. And that's the ship that Gail will be on.
Mm-hmm.
And asked Secretary Clinton to urge the Israeli government to ensure the safety of the U.S. peace activists aboard the Audacity of Hope as they join with an international flotilla to break the blockade of Gaza. And it says, Madam Secretary, will you urge Israel to ensure safe passage for the U.S. Citizens aboard the U.S. boat to Gaza, the Audacity of Hope, and signed the petition and so on. So I'm asking everybody who's listening, please do that.
And if you'll recall, last year that the boat that the people, there was an American who was killed,
right.
And nine other people were killed. They were bringing humanitarian aid. On the Audacity of Hope, they're not bringing humanitarian aid for the simple reason that anything that they bring could be designated as aiding the enemy.
So what they are doing is they're asking people to, and I'm going to ask you to go to thestruggle.org, and they're telling you to write letters of support for the people of Gaza. And write letters encouraging them, and
yeah,
so on, and
letting them know that they're remembered.
And emails, to them, and that will be greatly appreciated. But anyway, there's one more thing that I wanted to read about almost half of the Gaza is jobless.
Oh, something like the U.S., huh?
Yeah.
Well, they have a blockade and a boycott around that area.
This is put out by BBC News.
Gaza unemployment levels among the worst in the world. I can understand that. They're not allowed any things into their country. No wood, no building materials, anything.
And there's no government. Really, basically Hamas, but there really is no government there, and everything is being blocked and destroyed. So, and all the surrounding has been bombed and killed, and it's just horrible. And the Gaza unemployment rate is among the world's highest at 45.2% in the late 2010. The UN has found as Israel's blockade of the territory enters its fifth year. Real wages, meanwhile, fell by more than a third, and the UN Relief and Work Agency for Palestine Refugees said. Its report says that private businesses have been hardest hit by the continuing ban on virtually all exports. And Israel tightened sanctions on Gaza in 2006 after militants captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. The blockade was tightened again a year later when Hamas ousted rival Palestinian organization Fatah from the territory.
Boost to Hamas. UN Arwa spokesman Chris Guinness said of the report in a statement, these are disturbing trends, and the refugees who make up two-thirds of Gaza's 1.5 million population were the worst hit. The unemployment figure for the second half of 2010 was a slight improvement on the 45.7% jobless rate during the same period in 2009. But it was an increase from the first half of 2010 when temporary building boom boosted jobs. The UN report says while private businesses have suffered most, the Hamas-run public sector is one of the few areas where there has been economic growth, with the government employing tens of thousands of people. Mr. Guinness said the research had found that since 2007, Hamas had been able to increase public employment by at least one-fifth. If the aim of the blockade policy was to weaken the Hamas administration, the public employment numbers suggest this has failed, he added.
Except
Israel.
Yeah, except Israel.
ACCEPT, except
right.
Israel. Israel says the measures against Gaza are necessary to stop weapons smuggling and to put pressure on Hamas, but the UN insists the restrictions amount to collective punishment of Gaza's population. The Israeli Foreign Policy Minister spokesman, Yigal Palmor, says Israel is not against Hamas improving Gaza's economy or running the territory, but wants them to recognize Israel. Well, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Stranglehold the people. We are totally in favor of Hamas accepting the international community's preconditions to become an interlocutor, he told the BBC's World Service Organization Today program. If they only accepted that, surely that's not too much to ask. To recognize Israel, to agree to negotiate with Israel, then Hamas would be accepted by Israel too as an interlocutor, and that would certainly immediately alleviate the plight of Gaza. But Hamas insists on remaining committed only to an all-out war, and that is the systemic explanation of what is happening in Gaza. None of this is true. The restrictions were eased by Israel last year in response to international pressure after 9 Turkish activists were killed in clashes with Israeli troops who boarded their aid flotilla, which was trying to break the blockade. Restrictions at Gaza's border with Egypt have been eased since the ousting of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak this year. A change of policy by Cairo has seen the southern border crossing at Rafah open daily for civilian traffic, but not for trade. Although Hamas won Palestinian legislative elections in January 2006, it refuses to recognize Israel or to renounce violence and is designated in the West as a terror organization.
Right. Well, they're the only ones fighting this foolishness, you know? And I want it to be read. And there's one other that tonight that I want to read, and I think it's this was kind of interesting since it brought up the whiner, right?
Uh-huh.
But whiner's ignorance is beyond the pale when it comes to Palestine. And I wanted to read this. This is by the Daily Star. Coming up right now.
I never heard of that. Oh, Lebanese.
Weiner, yeah, no. This is a Lebanese newspaper. The Weiner ignorance more scandalous than his lewd photos in Beirut. U.S. Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner has come under fire in recent weeks after admitting to sending lewd images to women over the internet. But Middle East policy experts say the international scandal over the lawmaker's private behavior pales in comparison to the more egregious offenses he has committed against the people in the region. As Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan and Middle East expert and analyst, recently wrote in his blog-informed comment, the real scandal surrounding Anthony Weiner is that he is bigoted against Palestinians. Weiner is so blinded by his allegiance to Israel and so studied in his arrogance of the Middle East that he has played a uniformly sinister role in that aspect of foreign policy. Weiner's claim that Israel is the only true democracy in the region and moves such as calling for Columbia University professor Joseph Massad to step down based on student claims of anti-Semitism, which turned out to have no basis, are common enough in American pro-Israel politics. However, many of Weiner's stances and actions on the issues have betrayed a dangerous lack of understanding in the region, and the media fixation on other issues is worrying, analysts say. As Asad Abu Khalil, a professor of political science at California State University and author of the Angry Arab blog, told Daily Star, when media attention focuses on issues such as Weiner's preoccupation with photographing certain body parts rather than those issues which affect people's lives in the Middle East, it says that some insults and offenses against Arab and Muslims are not only permitted, but they are even encouraged in the political calculation of the U.S. And consistently and avidly pro-Israel, Weiner, in May 2006, called for the Palestinian delegation to be refused entry into the U.N., stating that they should start packing their little Palestinian terrorist bags. He justified this stance in an interview on Democracy Now! In September of that year, saying the PLO is a terrorist organization. It's acknowledged as a terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department. Yeah, that's a crock of shit. And anybody who doesn't believe in the U.S. State Department is a terrorist. In actuality, the PLO was removed from the U.S. terror blacklist nearly 20 years beforehand in 1988. Okay? So he then claimed that Mahmoud Abbas, who has headed the Palestinian Liberation Organization since Yasser Arafat's death in 2004, does not in fact hold said position, stating, Mahmoud Abbas does not represent, I hope he doesn't represent the PLO. He certainly doesn't say he does, and he represents the Palestinian Authority. The guy's a freaking idiot, all right? The guy's a complete poop.
Well, first of all, he thinks Israel is a democracy.
Yeah.
That's the right start right there.
Israel is a Zionist,
it's
communist
a
state.
Theocracy.
It's insane. But anyway, it goes on. And I highly recommend that you look at this because it's also on, posted on my Facebook, if anybody on Facebook right now is listening to this show.
But unfortunately, that's the way most of Congress thinks. It's not just limited to him.
But look up the Daily Star, which is a Lebanese paper. You'll get the whole print, the whole thing on that. This is the last thing I wanted to do tonight. I know we're running a lot with this, but I wanted to play this this tape. It's about 4 minutes long, and it's Gail Townsend and her interview with Stan Heller and the producer of the Struggle. .org, okay, Media for Justice. You mind if I play it?
No, go right ahead.
Because I
did a good job interviewing
excellent
her.
Excellent job, yeah.
And this is about the up-and-coming trip on the Audacity of Hope. Is that what it was? The Audacity?
Yeah.
The Audacity.
The Audacity of Hope. As Gail Corey Townsend, this is...
On the U.S. boat to Gaza.
I'll be speaking with Gail Corey Townsend, who's one of the people who will be on the U.S. boat to Gaza come this June. Gail, tell us about this project, the U.S. boat to Gaza.
Well, the U.S. boat to Gaza is part of an international flotilla that's going to involve around 22 countries and maybe more than 15 boats. The organizing group is hoping to get about 1,000 people or more to go on this flotilla to break the siege of Gaza.
Now, there was a flotilla last year that was treated very unfortunately.
Yes, there was. It was a smaller flotilla. There was a large boat from Turkey called the Mavi Marmara, and the Israeli military force came onto the boat and basically executed 9 people, including an American.
Now, I want to find out about yourself, because the Israeli government is saying this flotilla is an effort by Islamic terrorists. Tell us about Gail Corey Townsend.
Well, I'm not an Islamic terrorist. My grandfather was a Christian priest from Jerusalem. I'm a Christian. And the people that I know who are on the flotilla, on the American boat to Gaza, none of them are Islamic terrorists. And I'm not even sure if any of them are Islamic, actually.
And in fact, last year, as far as I know, people went to enormous trouble to make sure there wasn't any kind of weapon and that all the cargo was inspected, and still they were met with violence.
Right. Well, this year the U.S. boat to Gaza is not carrying any humanitarian aid. The only thing that we'll be taking will be hopefully thousands of letters to the people of Gaza expressing solidarity from Americans, ordinary Americans, and hope. Basically, the message of this flotilla, this trip to Gaza, is one to bring hope to the Gazan people. 1.5 million people in Gaza live under the most oppressive kind of occupation, and they have a horrible life. it's a message of human rights and hope for the future.
Now, tell me more about yourself. You mentioned your grandfather, but where do you live, your profession, and so on, your interests and business?
Mm-hmm. My family, my background is Palestinian and Lebanese. I was born in Canada. I live in Connecticut. I'm a journalist. I work for an Indian Native American publication. We have a website and a magazine, and I draw very much similar parallels between what happened to American Indians in this country with the advent of settler colonialism, with what is happening in historic Palestine and the colonization of historic Palestine.
And perhaps, how long have you been active on this issue?
For about 10 years.
What got 10 years would be 2001.
Right, exactly so. Well, even though my background is Arab, like most North Americans, I didn't know very much about the situation in Israel and Palestine until I was doing a Master of Fine Arts degree in poetry, and I chose as my final project, you have to give a lecture and write a paper, and so I chose to study Palestinian poetry for the last 6 months of my degree, my graduate work, and that's what really opened my eyes to the whole historic, what happened historically in Palestine. They say that art is the history of everything, and it certainly was revealing to me. And so
there's a slight problem with the
audio
portion.
Yeah, it worked fine yesterday when we listened to it. That's to be
honest. Yeah.
I don't know why it has all those colors.
After finishing my degree, I had always wanted to go to the Middle East. My sister had gone to Lebanon years ago. And after I finished my degree, I promised myself I would make that trip. And then a friend of mine, or at least a woman who became a friend of mine, was giving a talk in 2000, early 2001. She had just come back from Palestine, and she talked about the occupation and what was happening after the outbreak of the Second Intifada. And I was determined to go. And so I made my first trip there in the summer of 2001 with the Christian Peacemaker team. And it was an eye-opener. It was an eye-opener. I came under fire. It was incredible. And then I returned again the next spring, just in time for the Israeli invasion, re-invasion of the West Bank. So that was a total war zone. And
you were in Nablus and they were blowing up buildings?
Actually, I was in Bethlehem when they were blowing up buildings, and then went to Ramallah and went to Jenin. And it was horrific, unimaginable for ordinary Americans. And so while there's some risk involved in this boat to Gaza, it's nothing compared to the risk that Palestinians experience every day of their lives living under this horrific occupation, illegal occupation, I might add, because it is illegal. Under international law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Gail Corey Townsend. She's
leaving this weekend to be on the American boat to Gaza. Very brave lady, and also going with Libor. I don't know what his I can't pronounce his last name.
He's Czechoslovakian
and Polish, I think.
Right. And
he is also representing his country.
Libor, it's Libor von Schonau. Libor von Schonau. Schonau is his name. And we met him also that day.
Very well-spoken young guy. And
and
he will also be on the boat to Gaza.
This is something fascinating. This is just one more. I know we spent the first half hour on this, and it's. But there was a revolting U.S. statement on Flotilla 2, which it's a very short article, but I wanted to mention it. And you can see this on the struggle also, .org.
The lawyers and the State Department are working overtime to make up excuses for Israeli forces to attack U.S. citizens and commandeer and steal U.S. and foreign property aboard this month's Gaza Freedom Flotilla 2. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said the flotilla would be, and this is a quote, provocative and irresponsible actions that could lead to violence, even though the most high UN Security Council demanded Israel leave the Gaza Strip in 1967, the U.S. regards Israel as the ruler of the Gaza Strip, able to do with it what it wants, so it can kill Gaza
Fisher
trying to go out a few. Fishermen trying to go out a few miles into the sea. It can attack and kill heroic human rights activists trying to go to the Gaza by sea. Defend the lives of U.S. citizens, not when they interfere with imperial policy. With 100% Obama administration support, Israel feels free to do whatever it wants with the new flotilla, Haaretz reported. Former Chief of Staff Gabi Ashkenazi testified before the Terkel Committee investigating the flotilla, and said that if necessary, sniper fire would be used to take down violent protesters. This would prevent face-to-face clashes that hold a greater risk to soldiers' lives. The Terkel Committee was the group Israel set up to whitewash its actions in killing 9 aboard the Mavi Marmara. And that was the last boat.
And our guest will be joining us in the next minute.
Mm-hmm.
Lila's going to read a little introduction here of her book.
Yeah. Let me just get her on the. All
right.
Make sure she can hear us.
Okay.
And before we introduce her, we'll talk a little bit about who she is.
Okay.
And
just an introduction of our guest, Sherry Winston.
Let's see.
And our new book,
Sherry.
Women's Anatomy of Arousal.
Yeah.
Hello.
Sherry, we're going to read a little bit about you before we talk with you, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. Sherry Winston is a highly trained medical professional, sex teacher, and author who is on a mission to transform our culture's attitudes about sex. Sherry Winston is one of the country's most respected teachers about sex and sexuality. Her specialized knowledge is derived in large measure from her 2-decade career as a certified nurse midwife and gynecological practitioner. She has been a sex teacher for a decade and is the founder and executive director of the Center for the Intimate Arts. She teaches at educational institutions, women's conferences, sexuality boutiques, and other venues. And, of course, there's much, much more to say about you, Sherry, and welcome to the L.A. Steel Show.
Thank you so
Sherry,
much for
you
having
with us?
Me.
Yeah.
Pleasure to be here.
Oh, great.
Well, how do we begin this?
Tell us, first of all, we read a little bit about your background there. What prompted you to write this book? I mean, you're such a busy woman. I could hardly believe you had even time to write this book.
Well, the book, Women's Anatomy of Arousal, Secret Maps to Buried Pleasure, was actually a book I'd envisioned writing way back when I was a midwife. I haven't actually been catching babies for about a dozen years now, but even back then, I was starting to really see how women's bodies, our anatomy, our sexuality, and our birthing experiences were not just connected, that they were all one integral system. So I was really envisioning this book way back then. And then as I transitioned into being a teacher about sexuality and relationships, I kept feeling this book wanting to get written, and it definitely did take me quite a while to figure out how to find the time to do it. But the information that's in it is so vital for so many things. I mean, certainly for pleasure, but also for health and satisfaction, that it was sort of demanding to get out.
Well, it's a wonderful book.
I found that the most, I think what fascinated me about this, what, more so was about your book and about coming out with this book, was that I could never really understand, my whole life, I could never really understand why there were so many taboos placed on sexuality, okay, on the teaching of sexuality, understanding of sexuality. I mean, even the birds and the bees, I mean, you know, when you're a kid, don't masturbate, don't do this, don't do that, it'll make you go blind. All these other crazy things that forbid. That these cultural and mores that just seem to so
prevent us from pleasure.
Not only prevent us from pleasure, but create these perversities or these perversions, because they're suddenly saying that it's taboo, you know, to pleasure your body, or even to understand your body.
It's really wonderful that you've come out with this book that's very readable and very, very understandable.
Well, yes, but my question was is that can you explain why in your book you attempted to, but I'm saying can you explain to the audience why these taboos were created to begin with, and why sex has become so misunderstood, you know, throughout the millennium, you know?
Well, it's a really great question, and I have to say that, you know, for the first decade of my career as a midwife and a childbirth educator, I struggled with that from the realm of the birth world and helping women not just have empowering births, but to have amazing birth experiences and then their mothering experiences and breastfeeding and all those things. So I certainly struggled to understand why, when I was doing a woman's, her pap smear and her pelvic exam, why women would say, "Ooh, I can't believe you spend all day looking down there," you know, or if I would ask a woman while she was pregnant if she was planning on breastfeeding, and she would not only say no, but kind of shudder as if that was the most disgusting thing she'd ever heard of. And I did struggle for a long time. So, I mean, I've studied a lot of the history of Western culture. And I think it's important to understand that we're kind of now crawling out from under centuries, really millennia, of sex-negative culture that was part of the whole Western cultural idea of sex as sinful, and that the body is profane, and that in order to be spiritual, we have to rise above it, we have to get beyond it. So I think we live in a really interesting time, because we're still dealing with a lot of that taboo and shame. At the same time, we live in this weird culture where sex is just in your face all the time, every magazine and movie and book. So I think we're in a unique position.
But it's not the proper way. It's a perverted, since it's sensationalized approach to it, you know, the horrorizing of Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and Madonna and now giving bikini bras to 7-year-olds and stuff like that with Abercrombie and Fitch. The marketing and the sexploitation is becoming is there in the Western society, because we really still have these incredible taboos and on sex, and I as a male, I can't imagine what it's like being a female in this society, because it's so oppressive. It must be like a Muslim society where they still circumcise women, you know, but not quite as bad here. But mentally, they seem to circumcise women in the West. You know,
I think it's a great challenge. We have this cultural model of sex that's very shallow and about titillation and how things look that doesn't really help people feel connected to themselves, feel empowered in themselves, or it doesn't really help people to have great sex or great relationships. And so it is a very strange, I like to call it sometimes the pornification of American culture, but we really struggle with that. At the same time, we also have unprecedented freedom. I mean, the truth is, if we lived in a Muslim country, I wouldn't be able to walk down the street in some of those countries by myself or get a higher education or do the work I'm doing. So it is this weird mix that we have. But I do, it's part of why I'm doing the work I'm doing, which is really about trying to be a catalyst to transform our cultural model of sex into one that honors sexuality and respects it and understands there's this wonderful body of knowledge that can be shared and passed down that's going to help people make responsible and respectful choices about their sexuality and who they share it with and how they share it and how to be in relationships with integrity. And we really lack all of those models. I mean, we see it in the news, you know, every week with the newest sex scandal of the week, and that people don't have good models for how to be in relationship with their sexuality or with other people.
What is the, this is one of the questions that I posed to you, what is the biggest indicator in our society that influences our sexuality?
Well, I mean, the media is ubiquitous. The media, the internet, I mean, we're all wired in and hooked up. But it's, you know, it's the water we swim in. It's all around us. It's in everything. So I can't really sort of totally just point one finger and go, it's the media, because even that isn't just one thing. But I think, you know, I think it's part of our responsibility as individuals to try and shift our culture into a model that's both positive about sexuality without being degrading or diminishing the power of sexuality.
Well, recently in the media has been absorbed with Congressman Wiener, and he now has put himself in rehab for sex addiction.
Yeah,
I presume for
2 weeks.
Do you think that there really is such a thing as a sex addiction?
It's a model that I don't really use because I think it's a very limiting model. There are certainly people who behave in compulsive ways around their sexuality, as well as many other things, right? I mean, there are people who are compulsive about, you know, food and different kinds of drugs and work and dysfunctional relationships. So there's a lot of that manifesting. But I don't think that that's necessarily the most useful model to use for people whose sexuality is causing them to make really bad choices. And I just have to say, I still don't really understand how anyone at this point in the political arena can think they can get away with anything. I mean, seriously, do they have to tell anyone to believe that?
You know, I was thinking of this. I don't know if you saw it or not, but I think it was MTV or VH1 had Dr. Drew and his sex clinic.
Therapist, yeah.
You know, he had a sex rehab, a show on sex rehab, and he had about 10 celebrities that committed themselves to the rehab facility for sexual addiction. I don't know. I mean, you know, you had a couple of porn stars, and you had a couple of they had more problems with drinking and drugs than they really did with the sex. But you had male figures that had sex problems, and of course, Tiger Woods supposedly has a sex problem, and so many of these others. I mean, it appears that the media and also acclaimed physicians and therapists claim that sex addiction does exist. So, what I don't know, as lay people, I don't know what can we how do we look at this as a disease?
Well, a lot of people look at it as an excuse. for bad behavior, bad sexual behavior.
Well, I agree that often it is an excuse for bad behavior. And I'll tell you what one of my problems with that model is. I actually have watched the show a couple of times because, you know, I really wanted to see what their model is. And one of the things that they did on this show was that the people who were in rehab were not allowed to self-pleasure, to masturbate. And to me, that's completely the wrong approach. What I would do with those people is actually help them develop their sexual relationship with themselves and their whole relationship with themselves so that they can connect to their sexual energy as a source of power. And then when you can connect to it that way, it's not running you. You're able to tap into it and channel it and enjoy it with yourself and then have a lot more power and choice about who and when you share it with others. And so the reason that addiction model doesn't work for me is the addiction model says you can't do it at all. If you're an alcoholic, you can never have one drink. If you're a sex addict, you can't even self-pleasure. And that's why the addiction model doesn't work for me. I do agree that people have dysfunctional relationships with their sexuality, but I think the place to start healing that relationship is with their relationship with them, their whole being, with their whole selves, including...
I think I agree with you on that.
Now, have you treated people who have had so-called sex addictions yourself with
this
model that
you're
talking
about?
Have you helped people who... so-called sex addictions with your approach?
I do counseling with people. It's not my predominant work. Mostly I teach, but I do counseling, and I have worked with people whose relationship with their sexuality was dysfunctional and have been, I think, very successful in helping them find a positive relationship with their sexuality. I think part of the reason that people act out around their sexuality is because their relationship with themselves is full of shame and taboo and that, you know, good or bad model and that compartmentalizing. So my approach is really about helping people connect to themselves, to their sexuality, and to that power. And I find that seems to be a much more, not just useful approach, but an approach that values the pleasure of sex, that doesn't, the thing about telling people not to self-pleasure is now you're saying all sex is bad, and that's why the addiction model really just doesn't work for me. And it's one thing to choose to live the rest of your life without drinking alcohol, but are you going to go the rest of your life without having sexual pleasure? That doesn't make sense to me. That's why that model doesn't work for me.
I agree with you on that.
It's very difficult today to, our goal is to raise healthy kids with healthy views of sexuality, but it's very difficult for parents with the way sex is presented in the media. It's really a challenge for them. And very difficult. Yes, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I cannot agree with you more. And the appalling lack of really good sex education that we have. Those two things together are just a really bad double whammy for kids.
Yeah, I really believe that. This is my fundamental belief, is that the Christianity that's practiced in this country, the fundamentalist, all the insanity that's going on, creates such a hostile environment to any human physical attribute, whatever it may be. There are people out there that believe sex shouldn't even be enjoyed. It should just be for copulation and for production. You know what I mean? For reproduction.
Procreation.
And utter morons that exist on this planet, all right, that just blow me away. And I deal with them constantly in my life, and I deal constantly with people like that who listen to my show or, you know, that argue with my books or argue with whatever I have to say. But the what bothers me and the research I've done over the years regarding any of this, is that in the pagan society, the pagan cultures, they honored that. They honored the sexuality. They built statues to it.
They were a matriarchal society.
But the thing was, is they had it right. Okay, I mean, the minute that the patriarchal system took over, I mean, the Jewish tradition. Well, actually, the Jews were actually early on were a matriarchal society,
mm-hmm.
right? But then they turned patriarchal, and then the Christianity came along, and then there was the total destruction of femininity. Okay, once the Christians took over. So I'm asking you, I guess, do you see a turn back to that? That feminine balance, yeah, to bring the balance back. Do you see women, in your practice, you said women have these strange reactions to natural things, to sex and breastfeeding and whatnot. Do you see any change now? Do you see women changing, especially since the 70s and 80s, with so much more freedom? You know, as far as reproductive freedom, what kind of changes do you see? Or do you see any?
Well, we're such a diverse culture that I'm going to have to acknowledge the people who are going to come to my classes or who are going to come to me are already people who are wanting to have better sex or better relationships, and they're already going to be in a certain camp of belief. I don't think I probably don't get a lot of fundamentalist Christians coming to my classes. although I have occasionally, had somebody where I'm talking about how when the way for women to learn how to have orgasms and for men to have more ejaculatory control starts with your relationship with yourself and your self-pleasuring. And I've occasionally had someone go, well, I'm a Christian, and I can't do that. My church says that that's not okay, and I have to admit that that's unusual, and it does stymie me a bit. So I'm not sure that I'm really seeing a cross-section of the population. But of the people I deal with, I certainly see more and more people who are acknowledging that sex is a good and powerful and wonderful thing, and that they're wanting it to be in their lives in a healthy way, whether they've got problems that they want to solve, or they're having good sex but they want to learn how to have extraordinary sex, or whether they're having relationship issues and they want to learn how to understand how men and women operate. So I definitely see a lot of people who want that and are really seeing how we need to move towards a balance of masculine and feminine energy and how out of balance we are in our personal lives and as a culture. So I'm certainly seeing a lot of that. I'm not sure that I'm really seeing a fair assessment of the entire culture, because when I look at studies of attitudes about sex education in schools,
mm-hmm.
or, then I'm sometimes shocked by the kinds of responses people have. So I'm definitely not seeing, I'm not really seeing a cross-section, but certainly in the world that I live in the world that I work in and the people who are coming to my classes, I see a lot of people who are actively engaging and wanting to create a sex-positive world. So I always have hope. I'm always optimistic.
I in your handout, it says that 40-50% of women and 60-75% of men commit adultery. Why do you think these numbers are so high?
Well, first I'll just qualify the numbers. In studies of fooling around or cheating, whatever you want to call it, the numbers are very vague for reasons. First of all, how we define it, how we define sex, how we define a monogamous relationship. But the statistics are pretty significant, and what it's showing is that a significant number of people are having relationships outside of their agreements, outside of their commitments. And I think that part of it is because we don't recognize the reality that we are each going to be attracted to more than one person. sexual attraction is normal and it's going to happen, and it doesn't matter if you're married or monogamous or not, you're going to meet people that you're going to feel attracted to. So I think we need to start with recognizing that that's just true about human beings. Human beings are not a naturally monogamous species. If we were, we wouldn't need all these laws and rules and taboos about how we shouldn't behave. So I think we should start with accepting human nature, which is we're going to lust after various people. And then the next thing we need to look at is, what can we do about it? If we recognize our sexuality as a force and a power that can be for sometimes like a tsunami, like a tidal wave. It's a really powerful force, and if we give people the tools, if we help people learn how to manage that energy, then they're going to make choices that are in alignment with their agreements. That is, if you've agreed to be monogamous, even if you're attracted to somebody and powerfully attracted, you're not going to fool around. You're going to honor your agreements. And if you decide that you want to be non-monogamous, then there are models of how to do that in a good and healthy way. There are people who are in consensual non-monogamy relationships where they've agreed to be honest and open, whether they're swingers or they're polyamorous. There are people who are exploring models of relationship that allow for multiple intimate relationships or multiple sexual relationships without cheating. And so I think it would be really useful if the people who really want to have more than one partner can acknowledge that for themselves and then get into relationships with other people that that's okay with. But if you're in a monogamy agreement, that you take responsibility. This is about being responsible. And if it really means that you decide you can no longer be monogamous, then before you fool around, you go to your monogamous partner and you say, I can't do this anymore. We need to either change our relationship agreements or we'll need to complete this relationship so that I can have the kinds of relationships I need to have. And these are all models we don't have, and so it leaves people with forces they can't manage, these powerful sexual forces, and it leaves them only the option of cheating or denying that power. So that's what we need. We need to give people models for how to be in responsible relationship where we can create relationships that actually work.
There was I don't know if you ever read it or heard about it, but there was a remarkable book, and it's still in print, but it was written by Napoleon Hill, and it was called Think and Grow Rich, and it's outsold more copies than the Bible actually in this country. But it was one of the first self-help books. But his main ingredient, his secret, okay, used by all the people that he interviewed, and he interviewed all of the major industrialists of that time period of the turn of the century.
Successful people.
All fabulously successful people. And he came up with laws of success. But the most important ingredient was sex and sexual transmutation, he called it. And taking your you know, we're all sexually charged, and some people are sexually charged more so than others. And he's saying what they learned is to use that sexual energy rather than use it in a debilitating way to recycle that, to use it in their personal life and recycle that energy into an industrial kind of work kind of way. And it was just a redirection of
powerful
energy. I was wondering if you've ever heard of that, because basically sex is the driving force behind us, you know.
It absolutely is. And I'm not familiar with that particular book, but all of the sacred sexuality traditions I've ever studied talk about the same thing, whether it's Tantra or Taoist sexuality practices or Cherokee
right.
sexuality practices, which is how to take this energy and do good with it and use
right.
it in a positive way, whether to empower yourself, to empower others. And that's learnable stuff. And that's sort of, that's actually kind of the key to all of the work I do, which is the idea that this is learnable stuff. You can learn how to manage your sexual energy, connect to it, expand it, channel it, and be at choice and in integrity with what you do with it, whether you channel it into service for the world, you know, whether you channel it into saving the world. I like to say saving the world one orgasm at a time, and
yeah,
that's what I'm doing here. But, you know, to let the people in on the fact that we can channel this for good. And that's what I'm all about.
There's one more question I really got to ask you, since it's on your pager. It says, banging boomers, 10 things aging people need to know to keep an active, enjoyable sex life. What are those 10 things that will change our lives here, you know, or maybe we, I don't know.
Well, as an aging boomer myself, I can tell you that one of the things is to consciously choose to continue to feed the fire of our sexual energy. When we're younger, it's like there's a fire there all the time, and it gets turned up when something arousing happens, but the fire's always going. As we get older, that fire starts to go down, and we have to consciously choose to go collect wood and build the fire. So the first thing is to make that choice, to value our sexuality and the pleasure we get with ourselves and or our partners, and consciously make time for it, value it enough that we make time for it. I think another important thing is to remember we're not 20 years old anymore, and that's okay. You know, when I was 20, I'd go out dancing all night and then sleep for an hour or two and get up and go to work the next day. You know, that's just not the reality when you're 50 or 60 years old. The reality is we do have a different amount of energy, and we shouldn't expect necessarily that sex is going to be as athletic or as frequent or as prolonged as it might have been when we were younger. At the same time, to recognize, because we're older and we're wiser and more experienced, that when we bring those gifts and those benefits that we've gotten from age into our sex, the quality can be higher and better than it ever was when we were younger. So I really do think true sexual maturity does tend to come with age and experience. So we can bring our life experience and wisdom into the bedroom and make use of that. On a more practical level, pillows and cushions are a really great thing. You know, you might have a bad back or shoulder or hips or knees. I mean, we often have body parts that are not working as well. And rather than just sort of giving up on a particular activity or a position, is to be creative and go, well, I might not be able to support my weight on my hands anymore because I've got a bad shoulder, but what if I have a big cushion over here or a foam block or a wedge and I could get creative and be in a similar position or do a similar thing and yet support my body physically. So I think it's a great opportunity for us to be creative.
You
know,
things like Viagra or testosterone treatments or estrogen treatments or those kind of things. Are those do those help out, or are those more marketing tools or gimmicks or what? Sell more drugs?
Well, I think that they can be useful when we really need them, and I'd like to point out that there are a lot of things we can do before we go down the road of pharmacology. And so as somebody who's been in the world of holistic healing for 30-something years, I'm not against using drugs and medications, but I think it's great if we can start with natural remedies, if we can use herbs, if we can make sure we're getting healthy exercise and enough sleep and drinking water. So I really want to start with learning how to take care of ourselves. And there are so many wonderful natural remedies we can use. There are herbs that are really sustaining to our body and help support those systems. So I'm a big fan of try those things, use those things first, and
what do you recommend for aphrodisiacs? I mean, for erectile dysfunction or low female whatever or whatever
you know,
the situation
like a lower libido, sex
low time. Libidos or any of that stuff. I mean, what kind of herbs, what kind of exercise, what kind of whatever would you recommend?
Well, the thing about plants is that they're herbs that are systemic tonics. And so as women are going through menopause, for example, there's an herb called Vitex, which is just a great female tonic. There are things like saw palmetto, which is a great male tonic. So without going into a lot of specifics, because there's so many helpful plants, depending, I would really encourage people get educated, talk to your local herbalist or natural healers to find the plants and supplements that are really going to support your system. But I will add that everybody's got what I like to call your own, very own toolkit, your holistic sexuality toolkit. So everybody's got the ability to learn how to use your body tools of breathing and sound and using your pelvic floor muscles. This is so key. Pelvic floor muscles, right there. If you get nothing else in this show, men and women, exercise. Use those pelvic floor muscles and learn how to get them strong and all the different things you can do with your pelvic floor muscles, and that's going to help keep your sexual organs healthy. It improves blood flow, and it stimulates the nerves, and it works on an energetic level, and it's a way of really amplifying our arousal and expanding our orgasm. So that's just one thing right there. Really learn how to use your pelvic floor muscles, besides the fact that it will help with your bowel health and your urinary health and keep your tissues juicy and moist and keep the blood flow going where you want it. So just something like that, everybody's got that. Everybody's got pelvic floor muscles. You can learn how to tune them up and use them to your advantage. Learning also practices like a sexual meditation practice, learning how to use your awareness and your attention. So those are things we can all do to ramp up our sexuality, whatever our age, but certainly the more we learn how to use our internal toolkit and then reach for those natural remedies, the less we're going to need things like Viagra. And isn't it great to know it's there if we really need it? And also be aware that there is no real Viagra for women. And things, drugs
hey,
like that don't
thought,
help all
hey,
men either.
What scares me the most about the thought of using that is this 4-hour or more erection, and then what happens if you do have that, and then causes potential blindness,
you certainly wouldn't use anything like that unless you were under the care of a physician.
But even so, you know, it's like, guys are popping those things right and left. I have guys in their 30s that are taking Viagra. I mean, it's really quite sad. I don't know, I don't know why they need it, but it's like, still 30 in their 30s is a little rough.
We really enjoyed your book, Sherry, and I think it's a very good read for anybody, young or old, and to reconnect us with our bodies and with what is natural. And I think it's a very positive book, and it really supports humanity in every possible way. And I love the way you've approached sexuality. And if our listeners would like to purchase your book, how can they go about doing that?
Well, you can find out more about the book, Women's Anatomy of Arousal, certainly on my website, which you can get to by, I run the Center for the Intimate Arts, and the URL you can use is theintimatearts.com, and that will get you to my website, where not only you can get the book, but you can find out about online classes and my schedule, and there's some free things you can download and all sorts of goodies on the website. So come visit theintimatearts.com. The book's also available on Amazon, so that's another way to get it. And I'll just throw in there that even though it is focused on female sexuality and women's bodies, there's a lot of information that applies to both men and women. And I also wrote it for men who love women. So
it's a very interesting guidebook. You had a lot of tips in there, little tips that you
It's well written, and we really appreciate it. And I hope it does very well.
Yes.
And maybe soon you could come back on our show. We really enjoyed interviewing
you. We would like
Sherry.
To have you back again, yeah, if that's all right with you.
I would love to come back. This is certainly my favorite topic, and I've really enjoyed talking to you both.
Oh,
all right.
You.
Good night, Sherry.
Have a pleasant evening.
Good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, now we're going to have Woody in the Ring coming up.
Into the ring with Woody.
Thank you, Lila. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. I'm back after a two-week hiatus on some personal time, and it's great to be back on air. How's the reception this evening? Am I coming through clearly enough?
Oh, you certainly are. It's good to hear you.
Great. All right, moving along. Tonight's topics. Wohan Johan, Mavs Triumph, and Yankee Woes. All right. Mets ace Johan Santana has suffered a little bit of a setback. According to Sandy Alderson, team GM, he declined to play at Johan's recent shoulder soreness. So here's a few bare facts. The pitcher, recovering from surgery last September to repair a torn capsule in his left shoulder, experienced soreness after his throwing program became more intense earlier this month. Santana, who apparently had been throwing off a mound, reverted to long tossing, which Alderson said he did with no pain. The next expect Santana return to the mound later this week, and then he'll begin the spring training phase of his rehabilitation. You know, obviously barring any reoccurring soreness. At the beginning of the season, the team had, kind of hoped to see Santana come back into the majors around the All-Star break. But, that seems like that's definitely not going to go down. I would say, given the timetable presented, sometime in August would be, much more realistic. And, there's certainly no guarantee he's going to be the Johan of Christmas past. We'll just have to wait and see. The thought process now is, they want to get him to the point where he would have been on the 14th of February. From that point, he'll proceed with his spring training, which could last as long as spring training typically does. Asked directly if he felt Santana had experienced a setback, Alderson said, "I wouldn't call it a setback. I would say it's one of those things that can occur, and we'll see how he responds the first time out." In any case, the team's focus is clearly and rightly on Santana's future, more so on this season. According to Alderson, they're not pushing the short-term envelope here. Johan is definitely, a major part of the Mets' pitching staff. He's their number one ace. He's been sorely missed this season, and he left early last season. So, it would be great for them to get him back. Back on the field. Certainly, they'd like to get their money's worth out of him. But at the same time, you certainly don't want to rush him back, especially since the Mets are probably about to have a fire sale in about the next, month or so once the trading deadline comes around. A lot of the Mets that are Mets now, are not going to be around, i.e. Carlos Beltran, K-Rod, Reyes possibly is up for grabs, but maybe not. I think Reyes might stick around. Personally, I think the Mets will probably try and keep Reyes, offer him some type of, in my mind, half-ass deal. And if Carl Crawford money doesn't appear for Reyes, then he'll remain a Met. But if it does appear for Reyes, then obviously whatever team offers him that 7-year big money deal, then Reyes will jump ship. But, you know, that may or may not happen. Reyes might get injured like he often does, and then his value will, you know, decrease. So we'll have to wait and see. Frankly, I would be surprised if Reyes, you know, contract year or not, is able to go the whole season without getting banged up. But again, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. Okay, moving on. The Dallas Mavericks won the NBA Finals on Sunday. I watched the game from beginning to end, and I was extremely impressed, you know, with the actual team that Dallas presented. They played more as a team than the Miami Heat did, and that's why they won the series. They were the better team. Miami certainly has put together a nice collection of individual stars. But until those stars, you know, kind of gel on the court, you know, that's just what they are, individual talents. And when you have a guy like LeBron, who seems to, I would say, shirk his duties in the fourth quarter rather than rise to the occasion as guys he's been compared to, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, and the like, you know, you're just not going to get anywhere. You know, when you have LeBron sitting outside the three-point line, catching passes from teammates, not even thinking about taking a couple of steps and trying to break somebody down, but immediately just passing the ball to whatever guy has the same uniform as him, you know, immediately. I mean, the guy was just passing the ball off real quick. I don't even think he was looking to see who like he was passing to. He was just like, oh, that's the ball for me. Oop, pass it right over. You know, until he gets, you know, a better low post game, you know, I mean, it's just not going to happen. And, you know, he certainly just does not rise to the occasion. And I would say the person that benefited the most from this finals was probably Michael Jordan, because now he never has to hear LeBron's name compared to him again. Because Michael Jordan certainly would never shirk his duties in the fourth quarter, neither would any of the other greats. And as much as I dislike Kobe Bryant, Kobe Bryant never took a shot that he didn't like either. And, you know, whether it be the first quarter or the fourth quarter, Kobe always trying to, you know, impose his will upon the game, whereas LeBron seems happy just to pass it off to anyone, whether it be another star or a bit player or whatever the case may be. Now, I watched some of the interviews after the game, and it was LeBron and Wade sitting next to each other up on the podium, and a reporter had asked them, you know, the word choke is being thrown around, so on and so forth. And LeBron sat there and he looked at Wade and he deferred to Wade and allowed Wade to answer the question first. I don't know. I mean, I just have really no respect for LeBron. He's supposed to be the man, and yet he defers to this other star player. I know it was like Wade's team and so on and so forth, but I kind of thought that, you know, LeBron would be the kind of guy where, yeah, sure, it's Wade's team, but at least he would be kind of like be the man. But it doesn't even, like, appear that way at all. He just appears to be, God, just happy to pass the buck. I don't know. I was just so not impressed with him. And then some of the comments that he made after the game, something to the effect of, you know, all the people that hate on him and, you know, he's going to go on with his fabulous fucking life of riding around in limousines and everything, you know, just implying that, you know, he's super rich and he could care less about Joe average fan that hates on him, you know, because he'll be going on with his life for the rest of the summer and whatever. Screw everybody else. I don't know. It was real sour grapes for him. To me, if he was any kind of man or any kind of real superstar, he should have just said, you know what? Didn't play a good series, didn't play a lot of good fourth quarter basketball, going to work harder, and I'll be back next year. I mean, that's what I would have said. I mean, and that's all he would have had to have said. But instead, you know, sour grapes, all the haters out there, and so on and so forth. But it was fine when he and Wade were yucking it up about Nowinski being, you know, Nowinski had a fever prior to game five, I believe it was five or game four or something, and they were kind of making fun of him because he had a real good performance and whatever. You know, it was just classless. And the more I see of Wade, the more classless I think he is too. I'm just so not impressed with that Miami Heat team. Those guys really just disgust me. And it's unfortunate because I think what will eventually happen is, you know, they'll get back to the finals because their talent is so great. that it's going to bring them back to the finals. And, you know, and the question is the West going to be able to put up a team that's going to be able to beat them once they kind of figure out what the deal is? I think for LeBron, he's probably going to have to see some type of sports psychologist in order to figure out this fourth quarter funk that he just constantly puts himself in. But, you know, that'll be for next season. And, you know, they have to sit around. They got a long time to sit around. It's going to be a long, bitter summer for him and the rest of the Heat. You know, remember last year when he and Bosh signed and they came out dancing to the music and the fog machine and they're low-fiving and high-fiving everybody and, you know, acting like they're ready to be anointed champs right on the spot? Well, that didn't work out this year. So we'll see what happens next year. Kudos to the NBA. They did great in the ratings this year. A lot of good playoff games. Makes you kind of want to watch basketball a little bit more, you know, which is a good thing. So anyway, moving on to the New York Yankees. Yankees are really banged up right now. You know, granted, they're still winning games. You know, they got by Cleveland. They won 3 out of 4 against Cleveland. But, you know, Barcelona is on the DL. And, that's obviously for 15 days. But who knows if 15 days is going to be enough for a hamstring. Hamstrings are kind of funny. Cologne is an older guy. He's also a heavier guy. So who knows whether 15 days is going to be enough or not. You know, he says that it is, but he eats a lot of cheeseburgers. And he's been pitching like a number one guy. So what are we going to do in the meantime, you know? Who's going to fill in for him? Certainly not Phil Hughes, who's been gone for quite some time and isn't going to be back for another month. Hughes, he's ready to test his arm. I guess he's ready to, you know, embark on his comeback. He hasn't pitched in 2 months and hasn't won a game this season. But the Yankee right-hander will be on the mound. I think he was on the mound today, and I think he threw 3 innings in a simulated game at the minor league box in Tampa. And I guess he's going to, you know, try and reclaim his health and his velocity and his promise, you know. So we'll have to wait and see. You know, he turns 25 later this month. He's, you know, he's still a young guy. He's been on the disabled list since the 15th. And, you know, the shoulder's definitely been giving him problems. And certainly if he comes back in a month, that will be great. You got to remember, he was an all-star last year. He won 18-8. He had a 4.19 ERA. And he appeared to be emerging as one of the game's best young righties before, you know, his arm was landing him on the DL. And considering all the rotation questions the Yankees have, you know, he would definitely provide, you know, strong in-season help. Because right now, I mean, the Yankees got trouble in the bullpen too. Chamberlain is gone for the season. And it's funny, if you look at Chamberlain, I mean, you look at the Java rules and everything else and all that other jazz, and look what it got him. Tommy John surgery. I mean, they babied the hell out of this guy, and he still ends up having to get Tommy John surgery. It's really too bad. He was having one of the best years going. Granted, the guy put on some weight, but his velocity was back up, had a lot of appearances, and looked really strong. You know, who knows what they're going to do about, you know, helping the bullpen. Maybe Hector Nwosi, you know, he could help out in relief. He also could probably start. I mean, who knows? But the Yankees definitely have a lot of issues. Derek Jeter just went on the injured reserve. Frankly, I don't know if that's going to hurt the team all that much. I kind of like Nunez. The kid's young. He's got a good bat. And, you know, maybe Jeter needs a little rest. You know, he's always banged up, which, you know, takes a little hit, you know, at his ability to play at a high level. I mean, the guy's a trooper. I give it to Jeter. I tip my cap to him. You know, the guy's a warrior. Always plays hurt. But now that he's older, playing hurt, you know, does it affect the team in a negative way? I think more so yes than when he was younger, where, you know, when his skills were, you know, still great, whereas now, you know, they're far diminished. And a banged-up player with diminishing skills, you know, not so good for the team. So I kind of like the Nunez in there for a couple weeks, and we'll see what happens. The catcher, Martin, is out. He's got a bad back. You know, that's going to call, you know, he's going to be out for 3 or 4 games. Cervelli is a good catcher, but he's not an everyday catcher. I mean, not in my book. You know, his bat isn't, you know, sometimes he gets some hits, but a lot of times, you know, he doesn't, you know, he's batting 195 or something. So, you know, we'll have to see. Yankees have a lot of issues, and the Red Sox are really kind of kicking ass right now. Red Sox are getting a lot of good pitching, and they're getting an awful lot of good hitting. It seems like everyone in that order right now is just hitting. I think their average, the team average, I think is like 287 or something, and their team ERA is also low. I don't have the exact figure on me, but Red Sox are just looking really good right now. I don't even know, like, if it was time to add a piece to the Red Sox, I don't even know what I would add. Whereas with the Yankees, there's a lot of holes right now. I mean, you know, we need a bat, we need a starter, and we need somebody in the bullpen. I mean, those are three major categories. And no one's going to be in a big rush to trade with the Yankees, certainly not at a decent price. You know, they always want to rake you over the coals because they know you have money, they know you have prospects, so on and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see what the Yankees do. Are they going to bring up some of the young guys, you know, kind of throw them into the fire? I mean, certainly that's what I would do. Supposedly there's some, you know, young guys in the pipeline that can throw hard. Well, bring them up. Let's get a look at them. It's been said that Joe Girardi has a problem with Jesus Montero, the catching prospect who has a really good bat. I think it would be a shame that, you know, if he hasn't been brought up because, you know, Girardi has some kind of beef with him. I mean, we need all the help we can get right now, in my mind. Even though Posada is certainly hitting, and he got a hit tonight, he had a double tonight, and he certainly looked a lot better at the plate. But again, you know, we'll have to wait and see. And the Red Sox are just marching right along, and the Yankees are going to have to keep step with them. The only thing, the advantage the Yankees have is, you know, you could be one pretty sure that the wild card is going to come out of the East, and they just pretty much just have to stay ahead of Tampa, which I don't think is going to be a problem because I think our talent is deeper than Tampa's. But again, well, you know, we'll have to wait and see. Baseball is a season of attrition. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my Woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, my partner Money Mike. That's it for this week. Let's hope for a little sunshine. Out.
Swagger.
Burnt Rubber Blues?
Nope, Swagger.
flag, or I don't see that.
I got it right here.
Oh. I don't have
I just wanted to touch on something that really a story that really fried my balls today, my butt, I should say. But it really aggravated me. And it was this Republican schmucko who, where is it? I'm finding it. Hang on a second. I'll find it. Hang on. I have to look for it here for a second. Right here.
GOP lawmaker calls for the U.S. to pull funding
if
UN recognizes
Palestine.
Yeah. So
who is he? This asshole name. Representative Stephen Chabot, a Republican from Ohio, introduced a resolution calling for the withholding of UN funding if the General Assembly recognizes a Palestinian state. Chabot said Tuesday that he hopes to dissuade any efforts by the Palestinians to circumvent peace negotiations by going directly to the United Nations for statehood recognition when the General Assembly convenes in September. Chabot is chairman of the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee in the Middle East and South Asia. How the hell did a shithead like that get in charge of something like that? You know, just amazing to me. All right. This is from the JewishJournal.com.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know,
this is what it says. He said, I felt it was very important to set down a marker to be very clear that there are those of us in Congress who are very concerned about this. Chabot told the
Jewish Journal.
Yeah, the non-binding resolution is a call for U.S. funding to the UN General Assembly to be withheld if the General Assembly adopts any resolution recognizing a Palestinian state outside formal negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. You wouldn't truly have a state, you just have one more irritant, one more thing that's going to cause disruption in that important part of the world, Chabot said. The goal is not to have this take this measure by having Palestinians backing down or the General Assembly indicating they don't want to take the risk of having U.S. dollars cut off. The measure does not currently have any co-sponsors. Good. But Chabot said he feels confident that he'll be able to recruit support among the colleagues in Congress when it's back in session next week.
He says, I have no concern that we won't be able to attain a significant number. But I'll guarantee you right now that they will, you know, If the UN declares that Palestinian state, then, you know, they're home free. And these Shabbat idiots are, you know.
I want to go down to the end of, because there was significant.
A lot of good stuff there.
We could keep going. No, there's other stuff I wanted to read before this. Keep going.
This one's good, too. The Tennessee well.
No, just keep going.
Okay. Which one?
No, it's not that. This doesn't look like what I was looking at.
This was interesting.
Yeah.
Alabama tornado recovery, FEMA rejection, vex April storm victims.
The tornado turned Jonathan Stewart's house into a pile of rubble, and it shows a picture. It literally is just a foundation.
Yeah, that's it.
On April 27th, nothing but bricks and debris scattered over a concrete slab. Days later, an inspector from the Federal Emergency Management Agency came to Stewart's address in Pleasant Grove, took some notes and pictures. 3 days later, Stewart received a letter saying he didn't qualify for a FEMA grant. One of the reasons, insufficient damage.
My God.
Based on your FEMA inspection, we have determined that the disaster has not caused your home to be unsafe to live in.
They don't have a home.
They have a space with a few cinder blocks.
My God, I mean, this is our FEMA.
I mean, what qualifies as an inhabitable home?
Attaboy, Brownie. Good job. Brownie's not there anymore, but other asshole is. All right.
Of Stewart and his wife, Lisa and I looked at the letter and laughed. He said, similarly,
Lashunta Tabb's house in
North Smithfield Manor has three damaged outer walls. It's stripped of its siding, and more than half of the roof is gone. There's no way to live there, she said, but after a FEMA inspection, she received a letter that was word for word what the Stewarts received, insufficient damage. Although the disaster may have caused some minor damage, both letters stated, It is reasonable to expect that you or your landlord to make these repairs. At this time, you're not eligible for FEMA housing assistance.
You must have a State Farm insurance agent as the FEMA head
yeah.
now. The State Farm denied all the Katrina workers, really,
yes.
all the Katrina flood-damaged people and everything.
These hard, head-scratching assessments, where the words don't seem to reflect reality, have been delivered to an unknown number of Alabama tornado victims. But FEMA says if insufficient damage is the top reason in Alabama that people are initially determined ineligible for FEMA grants. FEMA officials urge applicants who believe they were incorrectly declared ineligible for whatever reason to appeal. Many of the findings of insufficient damage aren't correct, according to Linda Lowe, a FEMA Deputy Branch Director for Individual Assistance. A lot of these people registered but didn't have damage, she said. Keith Arthur, FEMA's Inspection Service Coordinator for Alabama, said he couldn't be sure of what happened in individual cases, such as homes belonging to Tab and Stewart's. The truth of the findings can be easily determined on appeal, he said. But FEMA reported that as of Wednesday, less than 1% of the 25,081 applicants initially declared ineligible for any reason had appealed. FEMA couldn't provide a number for how many of those declarations were due to insufficient damage. Stewart said he now knows his insurance coverage will replace his house, so he would be ineligible for a FEMA grant anyway, but he wonders how many others would be eligible for housing assistance because they're uninsured or underinsured, got turned off by the findings of insufficient damage and have given up. FEMA spokeswoman Rena Balfa said getting people to appeal has been the agency's biggest hurdle. If you have a question why you received a determination of ineligibility, go in there to a disaster recovery center and let them look it up and help you find an appeal, she said. An applicant has 60 days from the date of determination letter to appeal.
A whole bunch of lawsuits against
yeah,
Vermont.
Yeah, it's a kind of
well,
a long article.
But, you know, but it was really fascinating, I thought. Fascinating stuff.
Well, the poor people, I mean, it's like a 1-2 punch.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just like, you know, kick you in the teeth and then insufficient. That it's so ridiculous, you know?
Let's go to the...
I was gonna throw this up on my
we'll
Facebook.
We'll do that later. Let's go.
Okay. Then we'll send down to Facebook. Anyway. Okay. Bad. Oops. Wait. Let's go down.
Okay. Go up.
Go up more?
Yeah.
Oh, this was one. I thought that one was very important to read.
Gold, oil, Africa, and why the West wants Gaddafi dead.
This is a very, very interesting. Because if you're considering why does the West want Gaddafi dead, this is why. Same reason they wanted Saddam Hussein dead.
Uh-huh.
The war raging in Libya since February is getting progressively worse as NATO forces engage in regime change and worse. An objective to kill Muammar Gaddafi. To eradicate his vision of a united Africa with a single currency backed by gold. Observers say implementing that vision would change the world power equation and threaten Western hegemony. In response, the United States and its NATO partners have determined Gaddafi must go and assume the role of judge, jury, and executioner. Hold on 1 second. If they kill Brother Gaddafi, I submit to you that American interests in Africa will come under severe strain, warned the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan on WPFW FM Spectrum Today program with Askaya Mohammed. And this is from the Final Call, which is the Farrakhan newsletter. But this was also written by Ryan Mohammed, contributing writer. That man has invested in Africa more than any other leader in the recent history of Africa's coming into political independence, he continued. The Muslim leader said America needs access to the mineral resources in Africa to be a viable power in the 21st century. Minister Farrakhan further pointed out that the April 1st radio interview that the current plot to kill Gaddafi comes at a time of great distress and decline for America. The fall of the dollar is a manifest loss of America's prestige and influence among the nations of the earth, and an indicator of her end. How America's wealth today? How is she doing financially? What is the deficit? Some say it's about $56 trillion, counting Social Security and Medicare. That's a big number. She's printing money, but there's nothing backing it, said Minister Farrakhan. In the book, The Fall of America, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad wrote, one of the greatest powers of America, America washer dollar. I don't understand what that is. But the loss of such power will bring any nation to weakness. So this is the media of exchange between nations. And the power, the English pound and the American dollar have been the power and beckoning light of these two great powers. But when the world went off the gold and silver standard, the financial doom of England and America was sealed. He explained, Mr. Muhammad said further that the fall of America is now visible and understandable. Long has Allah been gradually removing the power of the great and mighty America, while few have noticed it. This has been done by degrees, and they do not perceive it. But Mr. Muhammad warned America's fall serves as a sign of fate to her European counterparts. And analysts say introducing the gold dinar as the new medium of exchange would destroy dependence of the U.S. dollar, French franc, the British pound, and threatens the Western world. It would finally swing the global economic pendulum that would break Western domination over Africa and other developing countries. And attacking Colonel Gaddafi can be understood in the context of America and Europe fighting for their survival, which is an independent Africa jeopardizes. And Gaddafi's creation of an African investment bank in Libya and the African Monetary Fund to be based in Cameroon will supplant the IMF and undermine Western economic hegemony in Africa. That's pretty serious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So Gaddafi's creation of an African investment bank and the American Monetary Fund, the moves are also bad for France, because when the African Monetary Fund and the African Central Bank in Nigeria starts printing gold-backed currency, it would ring the death knell for the CFA franc, and through which Paris has able to maintain its neo-colonial grip on 14 former African colonies for the last 50 years. It is easy to understand the French wrath against Gaddafi, said Professor Jean-Paul Pugala of the Geneva School of Diplomacy. The idea, according to Gaddafi, was that African and Muslim nations would join together to create this new currency, and would use it to purchase oil and other resources in exclusion of the dollar and other currencies, said political analyst Anthony Weil. Do you want to read the rest of that?
Go ahead. I was just listening to that.
I don't know. But according to the International Monetary Fund, Libya's central bank is 100% state-owned and estimates that the bank has nearly 144 tons of gold in its vaults. If Colonel Gaddafi changed the purchasing term of his oil and other Libyan commodities sold on the world market and only accepted gold as payment, a policy like that would not be welcomed by the power elites who control the world's central banks. That would certainly be something that could cause his immediate dismissal, said Weil. And furthermore,
how did he get 144 tons of gold?
Well, in the Middle East, a lot of gold is transferred. Dubai only accepts gold, okay, in transfer. They don't accept this
paper dollars
and shit. Everything is done in gold. So, and it's the same with him. He's bought gold. You know, he's purchased gold, and they have their own central bank.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they probably got gold in Libya too, and they mint their own gold. You know, so that's why, you know, that's what he's got. But 144 tons. It sounds like a lot, but it's not really. I mean,
I don't know.
Well, at $1,500 an ounce, it probably is considerably a lot of money, but you know, but that would certainly be enough that could cause him to be dismissed, or assassinated. Furthermore, pricing oil in something other than the dollar would undercut the pedestal of U.S. power in the world. Although in trouble, dollar is the reserve currency based on a deal made with Saudi Arabia in 1971. That was Nixon who put that one together.
Mm-hmm.
Or I shouldn't say Nixon, I'd say Kissinger, in which the Saudis, as the world's largest oil producer, agreed to accept only dollars for oil. The Libyan affair has sparked a divide in the world community with the African Union and nations like Venezuela, China, and Cuba. And until recently, Russia, on one side, as voices of reason, caution, and respect for international law and honoring the UN mandate that set the parameters for engagement in Libya. And on the other side, are war hawkish American, France, Britain, and Italy pursuing regime changes and actively trying to assassinate Gaddafi, though they deny that aim. And
wow.
Yeah, this goes on and on and on and on. But it's really an excellent article, and I'm going to advise you to go to it. And you can get it at The Final Call, which is thefinalcall.com. Final, FINALCALL.com news. Okay?
Mm.
So go for it, guys. Learn about it. And see. What else did I want? It's been about 15 minutes. I wanted to. There's a couple other things here I wanted to. Oops.
Do you have any audios that you were going to play?
Yep.
So just hold on, folks.
Yeah, bear with us here for 1 minute, and I will get you what I need to get you here. I thought, I hate to keep going with the Israeli thing, but it scares the hell out of me. They really scare the hell out of me, personally. Control power cuts likely as sunstorm threatens national grid.
Mm-hmm.
That's in Britain. Okay,
yeah.
They expect it. They'll probably get it here, too.
Yeah.
Let's see, what was it?
There was something on the passing of the War Powers Act.
Well, I didn't see it here on this one for some reason. Sorry, folks. Just
Well, here's one. Who's afraid of the big bank and uncensored? We should play.
Yeah, that's 23 minutes long.
Just play a little piece of it.
Well, there was another one that I had that's much shorter. Just give me a second. Bear with me, folks. Sorry, it should have been lined up, I know. But... Okay, wait. It's up there.
Sometimes it's hard to find these things.
Yeah, once you get them, it sucks on you. There's this one here. There's 4 minutes long, but this one here is. Senate stands behind Israel and says, it's Russian TV, it says, are U.S. senators more concerned with Israel than problems at home?
So let's find out.
I think that's correct. Hang on a second.
Well, among the other issues U.S. senators are focusing on, an effort to remind Israel and the world that the U.S. stands by Israel on everything, even when the president says otherwise.
We believe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaths.
This statement by the president, which he has since backtracked on a bit, has led several U.S. senators to sponsor a resolution showing their support of Israel and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, with provisions like this, quote, whereas the United States has long recognized that a return to the 1967 lines would create a strategic military vulnerability for Israel and greatly impede its sovereign right to defend its borders, another provision in the bill, whereas Prime Minister of Israel Benjamin Netanyahu correctly stated that the 1967 lines were not boundaries of peace, they are the boundaries of repeated war. So multiple issues, both domestic and international, that senators can't seem to agree on, not even a little bit. But this is one that's getting support from all sides. Earlier I spoke to Alexander Coburn. He's the co-editor of Counterpunch as well as a contributing writer to The Nation magazine. He told me why he thinks several notable senators were willing to line up behind this resolution.
Well, you saw how Netanyahu was received in the U.S. Congress not so long ago. He was interrupted, 28 times by rapturous applause. That should give you a clue. When the members of the U.S. Congress have the issue of Israel in front of them, they think political survival. They think campaign money. That's it. I mean, the Congress is Israeli-occupied territory. So this time, Lieberman, of course, has been the U.S. Senator from Israel, the prime U.S. Senator from Israel for many, many years. No surprises there, but there's no surprises in the whole spectacle, which is why to expect any political movement to get ever past the U.S. Congress beneficial to the situation in the Middle East is totally impossible.
But let's talk about this. I mean, you mentioned that a lot of these senators, you know, politicians really across the board here in the U.S., they do get a lot of their funding from AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. They're a very powerful lobby here, a very powerful group. But there are so many other powerful groups and lobbies here in Washington. Why is it, do you think, that these politicians really, really feel, I mean, there's got to be some other reasons, ideological or whatever, that they really feel the need to stand in the corner of Israel time and time again?
Well, the ideology of a U.S. senator or U.S. congressman, for that matter, starts with getting reelected. That's ideologically very important to the politician. And they know fully well if they do not vote the way the lobby wants them to, or if they contravene the lobby, their political future might well be endangered. And they're right. There are many examples in recent U.S. political history, going back to President Bush Sr., who annoyed the Israel lobby, and they paid a political penalty. So they may be busy doing the bidding of the oil companies, of Israel, of the auto companies, you name it. But first and foremost, they know that the Israel lobby in their districts has real clout.
But I would argue that President Obama even went further than George H.W. Bush in terms of pushing Israel a little bit, in terms of, especially when he talked about in a recent speech about the 1967 borders. He'd gone pretty far, and a lot of people are saying that this resolution, that this bill proposed, is sort of a political game, that this is pushing back against Obama and making sure that he knows that he can't step on Israel's toes. You mentioned the numerous standing ovations. I know I just got back from Europe yesterday, and people there were absolutely shocked. You know, it's one thing for U.S. politicians behind closed doors to support Israel, but to be so blatant in their support, people not in this country, people everywhere else, were extremely shocked that the entire U.S. Congress seems to be in this position. Talk about that.
Well, let's start with Obama. Obama has been careful throughout his entire career, when it really matters, not to cross the lobby. And in fact, right before the election of 2008, he made an absolutely shameless speech to AIPAC. Now, as regards his statement about respecting 1967 borders, what he effectively did in that speech was nullify the possibility of the UN, you know, recognizing the bid of the Palestinians to declare national territory. I mean, these are difficult times for the U.S. Government. Obviously, they have the Middle East in flames. They don't want to seem incredibly partial to Israel, but everybody knows they are. They're trying to do a little bit of a dance to maintain some appearance that they're independent brokers in this. But as they say in America, when the rubber hits the road, they're going to go with Israel.
I had mentioned this before, and we didn't exactly get to it, but, you know, the perception in the U.S. versus the perception abroad. In the U.S., most people have come to accept that this is very normal, that, you know, as it states in the resolution, that it's the duty of the United States to support Israel. People in other countries, including, you know, even in Europe, in the U.K., think that this is a little crazy that especially U.S. lawmakers are so blatant in their support. Talk about perception as it differs here versus the rest of the world.
Well, when you look at Europe, though, I mean, they can say, well, we're not, you know, the U.S. is completely impossible and try and, but when it came to things like Gaza, practical issues on the ground, the EU was just as bad as the United States. It was absolutely appalling. So when you look at substance, in real efforts to drive the situation forward, you have to look not at Europe, not at the U.S., but elsewhere to see any substantive effort to change the situation. I mean, the Europeans love to say that the United States are fanatical and all the rest of it, but when they click their heels, when it push comes to shove.
That was co-editor of Counterpunch, as well as contributing writer to The Nation magazine, Alexander Coburn.
He's right on that.
Disturbingly so.
Is it just sick, you know?
It really, really is.
Freaking sick. This was really disturbing. We might end to this one tonight, but what happened here is a stealth vaccine laws allow children to consent
to vaccines.
Oh, this is
ridiculous. A current California bill, AB 499, will allow a minor who is 12 years of age or older to consent to medical care related to the prevention of sexually transmitted disease. That is, children as young as 12 be able to get the Gardasil or other STD vaccine without their parents' knowledge or consent if this bill passes.
These are ridiculous vaccines
that you don't need. Disturbingly, North Carolina has a much broader child consent law already on the books. Any minor may give effective consent for medical health services for the prevention of venereal disease and other diseases. I call these laws stealth vaccine laws because they provide for the administration of vaccines without the word vaccine or immunization appearing in the law. Thus, they may slip under the radar of anti-vaccine activists doing electronic searches for vaccine bills and laws using those terms.
Unbelievable.
Isn't that awful?
And these pharmaceutical companies, they pay these bastards off, and then
they just pass anything.
They get these damn laws. I mean, these guys are pigs. Freaking crooks and pigs. Where were we on that?
There are serious legal and moral problems with stealth vaccine bills and laws. First, they violate parents' fundamental constitutional rights. In Troxell versus Granville, 430 U.S. 57, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the Constitution permits a state to interfere with the rights of parents to rear their children only to prevent harm or prevent potential harm to a child. Troxell requires a threshold showing of harm that is lacking in the California bill and North Carolina law. Troxell also tells us that parents are presumed to be fit to make decisions that are in their children's best interest. So giving the children of every parent in the state the ability to consent to medical treatment at any time amounts to the state declaring that all parents are unfit regarding those matters to which the children are given authority to consent. Under Troxell, parents are presumed to be fit unless there is a showing of unfitness. So it's really breaking the law to do this. There is a second narrower constitutional issue in states that offer religious exemptions to immunizations. For legal purposes, a child's religious beliefs are deemed to be that of the parents, so the law that would allow a child to consent to an immunization would violate parents' First Amendment free exercise of religion rights. So there's a number of ways that that's, you know, it's kind of a long article. But it's all about law, and it's not that interesting. Basically, it's illegal to do this.
Yeah, it is. And
there's good law already on that's preceded this so that you could oppose this.
This should be sued. This is just sick. Just really sick shit. It just gets sicker and sicker out there. We only got a couple more.
2 minutes. The Enemy.
This song?
The Enemy, this song.
Must be a song.
Yeah.
That's about it, I guess.
Yep.
We can end by saying that Stanley Fischer stakes claim to IMF top job. Stanley Fischer, the Israeli central bank governor, has challenged Christine Lagarde's ability to run the International Monetary Fund by claiming that his training as an economist made him a superior candidate.
Sure,
Fischer is a goddamn Zionist, okay? And the last thing you want is an Israeli Zionist running the IMF. right, which is 51% owned by us, controlled by us. All right, but Fischer also, Fischer, whose interest is in the post, emerged over the weekend, said it is essential. The managing director of IMF has an academic training to help steer the world economy through the current crisis.
Yeah.
In normal times, you can probably rely on intuition, Fischer told the Wall Street Journal, but all the time in different countries, there are serious economic issues to be addressed. Now, you know, to me, anybody who, you know, if they nominate this son of a bitch for any post, for a post like that, okay, we're done. We're doomed. You give Israel you give Israel control of the IMF, you know. I mean, it's just, you know,
but
that
you
would be
control a, everything else.
Yeah, but if you control
including
the
our
IMF,
Congress.
You control the IMF, then what happens is they give all this monies to themselves, Israel, okay, or anybody they want, and deny funds to anybody they want, and completely, absolutely dominate the world. And of course, who is going to do that is none other than he's probably a Rothschild guy. All right, so it's like, you know, we're just damn doomed. So
that's it for the news.
That's
folks.
It for the news tonight, guys. And I want to thank everybody for joining us. And please join us next week. Or no, I'm sorry, not next week,
tomorrow.
For more news and views and.
And we thank Sherry for being on the show and Woody for In the Wing with Woody,
yes,
with his segment. And we'll talk to you tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Have a good evening, folks. Good night.
Good night, everybody.